the Chinese Football Podcast, brought to you by Wild East Football.
Hello, and welcome to the Chinese Football Podcast, brought to you by Wild East Football. We're pretty much the only place in Chinese football keeping a consistent lineup this month with a lot of ins and outs. And here to walk you through some of the latest headline-making news, I am your regular host, Steve Crooks, joined by our loyal panel of experts, Brendan Chemers in Beijing. How are you doing, Brendan?
I'm happy to be here, Steve.
And Cameron Wilson in Shanghai. How are you this week, Cam?
A very sweaty and a humid Shanghai. Hello, everybody.
In the summer sauna that is Shanghai. Well, we need to start with a couple of the headline transfers, and there's a few big names joining you there in Shanghai, Cam, with both of the sides going big on forwards in this transfer window. Let's start with the latest transfer, and as some people will be at pains to point out, the first transfer in a couple of years for the reigning champions, Shanghai International Port Group signing Marko Arnautovic. Cam, how do you think this one's going to go?
It's going to go terribly. He's well known as a troublemaker and a bit of a prickly character. And this kind of guy is basically the last kind of person you'd bring to China if you had any sense. So I'm not sure what's really behind it. It seems like a bit of a risk. SIBG have always had a relatively speaking, quite a sensible transfer policy, or certainly it's been relatively successful. So I don't know what's came over him this time.
Yeah, there does appear to be a lot of scepticism. Is that kind of scepticism surprise that you share as well, Brendan? Or do you see some merits in the move?
I mean, well, there's definitely merits in the move. As a striker, he sort of replicates Elkacin, being that big body in the middle. He has a decent enough scoring rate in some top leagues, so he has the potential to make a difference. But for me, it just seems SIPG really rushed this move, and they seemed like they were under the gun when they really didn't need to be. I'm not sure about, you know, the locker room cancer sort of situation, but the thing is that with Elkacin, Oscar, and Hulk, as well as the manager, they have this definite Portuguese clique in the locker room, and bringing in someone that doesn't speak Portuguese sort of breaks that up. I don't know how hard. I mean, I think he'll have a hard time sort of adjusting to Shanghai, and certainly he's going to really struggle to fill Elkacin's boots.
I mean, in his defense, I think there's an argument to be said that he is the kind of player who might thrive in the CSL. I mean, he's quick, he's strong, he's got technical ability as well. He's extremely confident in his own ability. He can score goals, he can make them. But there is a long history of kind of, he's one of those people who can start an argument in an empty room, I think. Cam, what really confuses me is that this is just very off-brand for a club that kind of positions itself as the nice, sensible son-in-law with the good haircut and no tattoos and so on. I mean, do you think he's going to integrate with all of his kind of nice teammates there?
No, he's not. And I spoke to some people inside SIPG, and they already said, the comment I got was that they were at the airport and they saw that even from his body language and the way he was kind of bristling at the airport when he arrived and was greeted by some fans there, but club officials, that he already looked like he'd taken the hump. So I don't think it's going to go well.
Yeah, there's certainly going to be more headlines to come out of this one way or the other. We'll keep watching it. Moving over to the blue side of town with a couple of transfers in for Shenhua. Bringing in both El Shawari, talking of troubled characters from Europe, and also Kim Shin-wook from Jeonbuk. Brendan, I'm going to come to you first, because you've led a chorus of a lot of fans of other teams I've seen who really think that Kim is a good pickup for Shenhua.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Kim is a big presence in the middle. He has a fairly solid scoring rate. It's dropped off a little bit, although he had a decent enough season last year and is doing pretty well for the league leaders this year. But I mean, every time he's come up against Guan, he's always played impressively, and I think he's really a great pickup. And I mean, I know there's some doubts about him, but I think him playing together with Igalo is really an ideal strike partnership that Shenhua, he's going to get a lot of goals, especially reuniting with Choi, who he has a long relationship with both at the national team and at Junbuk. I think it's a really good pickup by the side, unlike El Shuari, which could definitely go either way.
All of these kind of praise of the signing from outside Shanghai seems to have not seen the fact that, that Shenhua don't have any wingers or can't put a flat midfield four together to get the ball up to them. I don't know, how do you feel about these two signings, Cam, and what's the general kind of feeling on the ground in the fan blogosphere and so on at this point?
I think Kim's a good player, but he's totally the wrong signing for Shenhua. I don't think he's a good combination for Gallo at all. They're more or less the same kind of player. They're pretty big and physical and penalty box strikers. I think it's a typical Joe Jun signing. He brought Choi from Dailan to Shenhua, and now he's bringing Choi's favourite players from Korea. So I'm sure there'll be a big commission, a big cut on that for both of those guys. That's the real reason Kim's come at Shenhua. He'll definitely score goals. He's not like a terrible signing, but what Shenhua has effectively done is they've let Aguarin go, who's a really strong running defensive midfielder, and replaced him with a penalty box big striker. It doesn't make any sense from a football point of view. And for Shawari, it's a very risky, it's a big money signing, big name. He's a very good player if he plays well, but these guys, it's impossible to predict. He could turn out to be Tevez Mark II. He could turn out to be a CSL all-time great. I tend to think it's probably going to be another Tevez, but we just need to wait and see. The one thing I could say, at least, is that he is still in the prime of his career, and I think it's the first time Shenhua's actually signed someone of that age at that point in the career. So in that way, something's changed, but to be honest, I'm not very optimistic about either of these guys.
And is that a kind of lack of optimism that the local fans are sharing as well? There was a big kind of press conference to unveil them, the day before we're recording this. Is there excitement, or do people share our kind of puzzlement of how this is actually going to work on the pitch?
Well, there's a lot of different opinions. I mean, generally, fans get excited by these big signings, and it is quite exciting to a point, but you've got to remember, you just got to look at the big picture. This is like a vicious circle Shenhua's in. They sign these big players, it doesn't work out, then they change the coach, change the signings again and again and again and again and again and again. So what can you say? I mean, in isolation, sure, these two guys could be great, but you look at the pattern, it's not breaking the mould, and that's reflected in the support. I think a lot of supporters, they're thinking, oh yeah, it's great, oh, Jojun's back, oh well, at least he's going to keep us up, and oh yeah, we've got Kim, this big guy. I mean, back to Kim, I mean, thank you. I mean, he, that kind of player at this level would definitely make an impact, but he's never been outside Korea before, and he's 31, so it's not like a signing which has any real longevity to it. But anyway, I think the support are pretty divided, but on the whole, they're probably going to be quite excited by this, and of course they are, because that's why the club keeps doing it. They just think it's a way to buy themselves out of trouble.
Yeah, and to kind of carry some of that fan favour. Moving from Shanghai to Beijing and staying with teams in the relegation mix at this point, I know you don't have a lot of love, Brandon, for Renhe, but they seem to have done a little bit of decent business over the last week. Elvis Manu could be an interesting pickup, and perhaps more crucially, they've got rid of the manager who got them into this mess and brought back the guy who was doing such a good job before he went over to Spain in Luis Enrique. Do you think this is going to be a catalyst for them to charge up the table?
Such a good job is a pretty big overstatement. They were still a fairly mediocre side. I mean, they were just slightly above where they are now. I think this is just sort of the insanity of Chinese football, where you fire a manager, you get rid of a manager, and then 6 months later or a year later, you bring back the same guy. It makes zero sense. He doesn't have the players that he had. One of the jokes going around the Guan fans is that he's coming back and all of a sudden he's thinking to himself, where did Wang Gang go, who was an important part of that side, who's now on Guan? Yeah, I think it's some interesting moves. All these clubs at the bottom have to be desperate to be doing things. I mean, we've seen Dalian bring in a new manager in Rafa. Obviously, Shenhua making a number of moves, Renhu making these moves. I don't necessarily think these are good moves in a lot of cases. I think it's desperation, and you have to hope and pray that this guy's going to be able to adjust really fast or to figure things out really fast. And yeah, I'm not optimistic about this move for Renhu for sure.
Nice to have their previous achievements put very much in their place there as well. I enjoyed that greatly. Well, from one team that draws withering scorn from our panel to another one, I think we have to talk once again, Cam, about Evergrande. We all weren't quite sure how they were going to manage this entirely Chinese side, and now it appears they're going to just nationalize every Brazilian in China and re-sign them. I've lost count of how many they're at the moment, and more crucially for me, how on earth are they going to fit 7 forwards into their team?
I got to be honest, I have no idea what is going on with this naturalization thing. I've completely lost track of it, especially with Delago going to Shandong. It just seems like if the player's willing, he can be given Chinese nationality overnight. I mean, what's going on there? I mean, what are Evergrande going to do? How are they going to shoehorn all these forwards into the team? I mean, I must admit, I've got to be totally honest again, I did not see this coming at all. When I saw Evergrande say we're going to have an all-Chinese team by 2020, I never imagined that they would mean that we'd have a team full of Brazilians who were given Chinese passports. So that I thought they were more likely to simply choose not to have any foreigners at all. I just think it's just... I mean, it's testament to the power of Chinese football. Like, after all this time following the game, it still has the capacity to completely wrong foot people who've watched it for years like me. I did not see this coming, and I don't really understand at all what's happening. And all I can say is that it seems that in general, the Chinese football system, they're so desperate to improve that they're willing to compromise on things which have been a red line for them for a long time, like given nationality to people who have no Chinese ethnicity. I just never expected that to be happening, but it's yet to actually happen yet, so let's see how it works out. But when you've got all these guys going to Evergrande like that, then something's going to break pretty soon.
Yeah, and I think you made a good point. We haven't actually seen the final kind of naturalization process completed for a lot of these guys, so maybe we can come back to this one in future when we know exactly where it stands. But one thing I wanted to get your guys' thoughts on are kind of who the early losers in the Evergrande squad are, with kind of all of these Brazilians returning as well. It looks like Browning might be deregistered at this point, and they've just kind of loaned out, I think, He Chao to Jiangsu Suning. And this is a, you know, part of this new breed of kind of younger Chinese national team players who are getting minutes playing for them there, and it seemed to be going all right. I mean, is that quite disenfranchising, do you think, for those players? Do you think they're going to have a future back at Evergrande at some point, Brandon?
I mean, I think it's going to be, it's difficult. We've seen some guys that have gotten loaned out and have ended up coming back, but I mean, you got to wonder about He Chao. Has been in the national team a number of times over the year, in the past couple of years, and is a decent enough player. Now that he doesn't count as a U23 anymore, they're loaning him out. I mean, it's pretty surprising. He's been a fairly regular part of the squad this season, and he's not necessarily, if he's going to be replaced by these sort of foreigners who are Evergrande, who are suddenly Chinese, it's pretty shocking. Although I don't think that is going to be, I mean, like you said, I think it's, we just have to see what's going to happen here, because there's a lot of talk going on and we haven't really seen very much. I mean, Elkeson has been confirmed that he's going to Evergrande, but when he's going to get naturalized and whatnot, we still don't know. So I think there's a lot of just wait and see, especially with like Browning and Suchol. Suchou's parents were, his family was going through their ancestral village last week. No one's really sure where any of these naturalizations stand. So we'll have to see. But I think that the Chinese players on Evergrande are definitely the losers in all of this.
Yeah, there's got to be some people who haven't quite been given what they were promised in all of this, I think. But let's wait for the dust to settle before we really kind of cast our scorn over it. One other move that we could have actually talked talked about last week, and we didn't get a chance to, the wider football world, and a lot of China football observers actually are very excited about Yaya Toure playing his... coming out of retirement to play his trade in the second tier, actually, over in Qingdao. Cam, do you share the excitement about Yaya being in China?
No, I don't. I think he's past it and he's just picking up money. So I don't see any reason to be that excited about that. It'd be different if he was younger, but now he's, what, 36? It's just a bit cash.
The CSL has never really been that sort of retirement home like the MLS is. And, you know, players have come towards... the end of their career, but they're still not that far past peak. And so a situation like this, I'm hoping that we don't see more of these in the CSL. It's not good for the league.
Yeah, I mean, Carlos Tevez would beg to differ about the retirement league concept, but I'm in complete agreement with you guys. I mean, Toure, you could see in his later seasons in England, he was an amazing player at his peak, but his legs have gone, his engine's gone. He's kind of strolling around the pitch. It's not necessarily something that we should be that excited about.
Actually, Steve, I could
He is a huge name. Go on.
Just to interject with one start. Since 2015, he's only scored 11 goals. And that's from four seasons. So it's not a very good sign, is it?
Not quite the kind of rampaging, you know, box-to-box presence that people might be expecting. I mean, I think this, and the mention of it not really being a retirement league is actually quite interesting to follow up on when we look at some of the players who are coming over. You know, for newer and older listeners, this is a good chance for us maybe to recap. You know, what kind of players tend to be good pickups for CSL sides? What are you looking for in your ideal foreign signing in terms of both, you know, technical and physical and maybe kind of mental and off the pitch factors as well? Cam, going to come to you first on this one.
I think a player's mental attributes are just as important, if not more important, than his actual skills. I think you need to be able to roll with the punches, accept a lot of things which to a high level player from Europe or even South America, they're just going to find a hard time. They're not going to have seen really. We're talking about amateur behaviour, excessive club politics, just the pressures of living in a country which is really quite different to European countries or even South America or elsewhere. I think it's quite a challenging thing. But I mean, on the flip side, if you're able to do this, then it can be a really rewarding thing, because don't forget that literally hundreds of thousands, a lot, I've done a number, but a lot of Westerners choose to live and work in China, and I think people do that for all sorts of reasons which are not necessarily connected with finance. So from our point of view, players can have a really rewarding career here, but they have to make big compromises in terms of the level of football and the level of professionalism which they get involved in. They have to be able to accept this, that it's not going to be quite as high as back home.
Yeah, I think it's really important to emphasise there as well, you're signing kind of a man and a character, not just a player. Anything to add to that, Brandon? What kind of player tends to work out? What kind of player tends not to work out? What should clubs be looking for or looking to avoid?
I mean, it's really a crapshoot, but you have to, it comes down to, you know, the guy has to, it can't all just be about the money. There has to be some willingness and ability to adapt. And you have to, I mean, you kind of look at their background and see where they've played before, what their previous experiences are in football, because you don't want these guys that have sort of stayed all in one country or something and then suddenly are coming over to China. Although, I mean, Pele worked, right? I mean, he did okay he's done okay at Shandong. He played outside of Italy a little bit, and he was considered a locker room cancer too at points in his career. So it's really just a total crapshoot. And the key is, I think, getting these guys over time. It's not something, if you just want a guy to come in and make an instant impact, it's going to be really difficult. But if you give guys time, they'll start to adapt and adjust and realize that their future of their career, they're making more money in China than they could anywhere else, and they should enjoy it.
And yeah, I think fascinating that on both counts, we've talked much less about the actual type of player and much more about the type of person and the character. And perhaps that explains some of our reservations at the top of the show there. But we'll keep on top of the additional transfer news as they come in. But for now, let's wrap that discussion up and move on to our Phenomenon of the Week section.
The Wild East Football Phenomenon of the Week.
Last week, the winner of the popular vote was a landslide win for the naturalisation bandwagon, perhaps unsurprisingly, with Fernandinho coming in second and Pedro Delgado trailing in third. All of which means, Brandon, this week you have an open slate and get to nominate first. Who or what has caught your eye in this week in Chinese football?
So I'm not going to go far past Beijing for this one and actually give it to something going on the field for the right reasons. And the goal that the third goal Jonathan Vieira scored the other night was just an amazing effort. It was great. It wasn't only him, but Zhang Yuning, really an amazing 1-2 there. Just a great combination. And that is goal of the season for me. So I'll give it to Vieira and Zhang Yuning.
For a good team goal. There's a lot both on and off the pitch to kind of nominate this week. I get to go second. I'm going to bring back one of our favourite friends, Punishment Bingo, in the commentary given by the disciplinary committee for suspending Fellaini for a kind of a stray elbow was something about how this had a negative impact on society. And, you know, I don't live in China anymore, so I need input from you guys on this. But have you seen your cities besieged by people kind of growing big curly afros and jumping in the air and elbowing people in the head? I mean,
no, but
down
I've
with
seen,
this kind
but
of
I've
thing.
I've seen people elbowing a lot on public transport trying to get a seat. So I think they're trying to stamp out that sort of thing. I think Fellaini's given a bad, he's given some encouragement to those who would push others out of the way to get an empty seat on the metro train.
He's a bit tall to get on a metro though, isn't he? He'd be stooping anyway. Cam, you won a landslide vote last week. Do you have a good candidate for us this week?
My nominations have won for what is the last couple of times in a row, so I'm going to have to make a crap one so I can go first the next time, since sometimes people take my
tactics.
Nomination. Yeah, yes. I'm going to nominate Freddy Guarin for being a foreign player who was a fairly big signing, not a massive one, but he was like a big money signing, good quality player, who actually I think had a solid 3 years at Shanghua, and he's left Shanghua as of yesterday. I think he is a pretty good example of what a player from abroad can come in and do for 3 years. So Fred, stability of Freddy, that's my phenomenon this week.
Ah, you've made me feel all emotional now. I've got lots of Freddy Guarin stories that I can tell another time, but that's a good round of options this week. As always, we look forward to seeing how the vote goes. Now, for the second part of the show, we've actually got a kind of long-form interview here with Chris Atkins, where we go in-depth on China's performance in the recent Women's World Cup, and also how viewers and listeners can get involved in following the women's game if they want to, as a follow-up to that. So here is Chris with his insight and perspective into women's football and its place in China. And for this section, we are joined by a familiar voice to long-term listeners of the pod. We've got one-time host and occasional pundit Chris Atkins online, who's going to share with us a bit of insight from his day job, where he can get someone who can talk with some semblance of knowledge about the recent Women's World Cup. Chris, great as always to have you back on the pod.
Thank you very much, Steve, and you're doing a great job in my former role.
Well, I just feel like we should be talking about Qin Sheng. Maybe you'll try to find a way to shoehorn him in, but I did I want to take the opportunity to reflect on a tournament that's got a lot of people talking across football media. We have had a few kind of listener questions on it as well. And now that the tournament's just wrapped up this week, it's a chance for us to look back on yet another disappointing international tournament for a Chinese national side. The flavour being it's, of course, the women that we're looking back on this time. Going out in the first knockout round, that's par for the course with the men lately. Was this about what was expected for the ladies, or was it more of a disappointing showing?
I think this time round it was pretty much where they're at. They've been hovering around kind of 15th, 16th in the world for probably 3 or 4 years now. So, I mean, the round of 16 in that sense is exactly where you'd expect them to be. I think the FA had grand schemes about, you know, they were going to reach the semi-finals after these 6 months of training camps that they had under Jia Xiuquan. But the truth is that they're not a world-class team at the moment, and probably the round of 16 is where they are.
And what are the key factors you think that are stopping them being a world-class side? Is it the same kind of lack of goals that we see with the men's team? I mean, they scored, what, one in this tournament. Is that down to a lack of flair and quality up front? Is it down to the tactics and the coach? Do they lack depth? Do they lack belief? What are the key kind of issues there?
I think the lack of goals this tournament was obviously a major concern, but it was in part due to how they were set up. They realized their defense was weak. On paper, China's defense was weaker than its attack. And to compensate, Jia Xiuquan obviously set out the team in a very defensive structure to make them very hard to break down. And I can kind of understand it when you're playing Germany and Spain in the group stage, but when they were playing South Africa in particular, you felt that they should have opened up more, especially when they've got, you know, Wang Shuang, who's for openness, I'll reveal a client of mine, but who's been a Paris Saint-Germain for the last year. She was Asian player at the Ligue last year in an attacking midfield role. With a player like that, also Wang Shanshan up front, Li Ying is also a very good striker. And you have to expect that against a team like South Africa, these players are going to be able to score you some goals, but they didn't open up. And it was the same when they reached the last 16 against Italy. I think they had one shot on target in the whole game, despite having about 60% possession. And Italy are a decent team, but they're no better than perhaps China. So if you're having that much possession, you should be creating more opportunities than just one shot on goal over the course of 90 minutes.
Statistics are pretty ugly reading in that sense. Do you think that the lack of goals is entirely down to the approach and the coach? And do you think that Jia's going to still be in charge as they gear up for their next tournament focus?
Regarding whether he's going to stay in charge, I honestly don't know at this point. I would doubt the FA are particularly impressed with how they played. I mean, while the results were perhaps as a lot of people would have predicted, the style of play and the outcome was not particularly impressive. I think they'd have much rather the team went down in the last 16 like Japan, playing in a more expansive, more attractive way that actually earns Chinese football some respect, rather than scoring one goal in four games. It's not something they're going to show off about over the next few years. But in terms of, it can't all be the coach's fault. The players do have to take some blame. And the whole system as a whole, the whole women's football environment, football in general, in terms of the youth training, they're obviously not producing the level or perhaps the depth of attacking talent or indeed talent across the pitch that other countries are. And what you've seen with the Women's World Cup this year was, I think I read that 7 of the 8 quarterfinalists were among the 8 countries with the most women's registered players in the world. And that shows that there's a direct correlation between the number of players and the outcome, basically. And so China's done a lot of work in the last few years to get more people playing, but the number of professional women's players in China or senior registered women's players in China is not that high still. You've only got, across the two top leagues, you've only got 16 teams, and then now they, since last year, they've had a third tier. But it's going to take some time to see that depth of talent come through. And to be honest, if it doesn't start from a very young age, it's still not going to come through, however many professional teams you have, with the men's clubs all now needing to have a women's team next year. It's going to be very interesting to see where they actually recruit players from.
Well, they could always naturalise some players, and maybe we'll get onto that a little bit later on in this chat. But I think that's a nice lead into a question I wanted to ask about. What do you think, or what have the CFA stated that their priorities are moving forwards? Is it growing the game? Is it growing the depth of the professional structure, getting more younger girls and younger women involved? Or do you think we're going to see closed ranks and a kind of military-like focus on the next tournament, which is presumably the Olympics?
I think with the CFA, you always get a kind of mixed message on those things. I think they have to do both, to be fair to them in that regard. They have to focus on short-term results as well as on the long-term. They will 100% close ranks, pull a group of players together and try and develop a core for the Olympics pretty much from the end of the season, and the end of this league season has been brought forward till I think it's the 22nd of September or 26th of September, and that's purely to accommodate a long training camp before the Olympics. So you're going to have the whole 14-match league season taking place between July the 13th and then September the 26th. So it's really cramming it in just to give the national team some build-up time before the Olympic qualifiers in what should be January or February. And that, to me, is crazy. I think if you don't respect your local league, then you're never going to develop the breadth of talent that you need. You have to, for me, the most important thing when developing a national team is the level of the domestic competition. And the CFA, at times you see it with the men's, not at times, you see it quite regularly. In order to develop the national team, they disrespect their own league competitions. And I think that's one thing that they can't afford to do. Then you need to have the league at a higher standard and as high a level of professionalism as possible in order to have a national team that's going to be able to compete. And I think women's football is the perfect example of that in terms of over the last 10 years, England, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, they've all professionalized their local leagues and their results have just gone through the roof. And that's why you have seven European teams in the quarterfinals, because the whole environment in those countries has been professionalized, whereas China is a professional league in perhaps name only.
Strong words, but it's hard to disagree with a lot of that. And I actually wanted to get some more input and just kind of explore why is it that, that they have declined over the years? Because the men's team, to a you know greater or lesser extent, have always been something of a joke, maybe a strong word, but they've struggled to compete. You know, they qualified only for the one tournament in living memory. But, you know, the women's team, and if I think back to when I first moved to China, I don't want to date myself here, but they were a very, very strong team kind of, you know, 10 to 15 years ago. And they have become also-rans. As you said, their ranking hovers around the mid-teens now. I mean, is this a case of the rest of the world catching up, increased competition internationally, or has there been at the same time a decline in the strength of the Chinese team? Was it just the golden generation that they had back then, or for some other reason are the players not coming through anymore?
I think part of it is other countries starting to take women's football more seriously, and you saw obviously maybe 10 years or so back the rise of Japan, particularly in Asian football. Australia coming into AFC has made the whole competition more competitive again. Korea have also improved. South Korea and North Korea have always been reasonably strong. So China now face a lot more competition within Asian football, which in a sense can only be good. But the truth is, and you've seen this at the World Cup, the level worldwide has massively improved, certainly at the top level. Perhaps South America and Africa have still got a long way to go, but Europe and North America are certainly leading the way in women's football at the moment. And China's fallen behind in those developments. I mean, you have, I've been around some of the facilities of Paris Saint-Germain, of Barcelona, Manchester City, and these are unbelievable training structures. Like Manchester City's women use an identical facility to their men's first team. They share it with the development squad for the men's, and they have everything you could possibly need to make it an environment that's going to produce top players. And some of the clubs in China, I mean Jiangsu Suning for example, have some very nice facilities, but the entire organization around the league, around the professional structure in China is still really lacking behind those countries. And while that's the case, even if you're producing talented youngsters, you know, they in the last few years they've produced obviously Wang Shuang, they've got a couple of players from their under 20 team from last year who are very talented, but you're not giving them that opportunity to really kick on to become world class if you don't provide them with that environment.
Were there any bright spots that came of the tournament, or is it really a case of kind of reflecting on the current standard of the team and doom and gloom?
I think the defense has to be seen as a bright spot. Everyone expected it to be difficult for them. Then the four defenders they put out perhaps not particularly highly rated, but certainly they stood up to the task well, and I guess we'll put them in good stead ahead of the Olympics. But to be honest, when you score one goal in four games, there's not really too much you can take from that, and that's where it's disappointing, really. As a fan of football, I would rather my team went out in the group stage trying to play than go one stage further, but really cruel to that stage. And that must be the frustration of being a Chinese football fan, whether it be men's or women's, is, okay, like you said, the men's teams get to the first knockout stage in a lot of these tournaments, but it's really, there's nothing to get excited about. And that's, I guess, what you want to see is some forward thinking, some progressive football, some young players starting to emerge, and you're just not seeing it right across the board in Chinese football. And perhaps now with Evergrande, at least this season, seem to have some younger players coming to the fore, perhaps we'll start to see it. But if you're bringing in a load of older Brazilians to play for the national team, are those guys going to get a chance anyway?
Yeah, and I think we have to touch on that. I wanted actually to discuss it. Do you think there's going to be any cross-pollination between the kind of heavy-handed government initiatives we're seeing between the men's and the women's game to kind of it looks like China could have an entirely a national team consisting entirely of second string Brazilians with the way that things are going at the moment, and with the women's team very much unlike Wule being encouraged to kind of spread his wings and play his trade overseas, we're seeing the stars kind of pulled back into domestic competition. Do you think there's a chance of seeing either of those two ideas crossing the gender divide, or does the CFA kind of keep its harebrained schemes separate for now?
No, I think there's a lot of coordination in the ideas, the long training camps, the military style training that the team went on earlier in the year. The players, to be fair, are being encouraged to go overseas. Wang Chuan returning was, oh, I stress this, as her agent, it was entirely her choice. The CFA didn't put any pressure on her. It was purely she wanted to return home. But the other players, they are trying to encourage, but the salaries are so good in China compared to Europe. I mean, people need to understand that European clubs are, at the top level, they're paying good salaries, but below that, it's really nothing out of the ordinary. It's in some of the salaries, you get better working in a very mediocre job outside of football. So it's not especially attractive as a Chinese player to go and play for a lower level team in Spain when you're going to be earning perhaps a fifth or sixth of what you can earn in China. So that's the big reason, I guess, that not many players are going overseas. These girls are now starting to become very well paid at home. And so there is going to be a cross-pollination of ideas. The CFA and certainly the general administration of sport are putting forward their proposals the same as they are with the men's team to try and improve results. But whether you're going to see naturalization, I don't know. I guess the big difference is at the moment, at least with so few teams and only generally two foreign players per team, and they have a maximum of three, most of those players are international. So you're not going to be able to naturalize them and put them in the national team.
Although, give it some time, who knows what they could do. But thanks for clearing some of those kind of social media rumours up anyway. It's nice for us to be able to get to the bottom of news stories rather than kind of be looking in from the outside here. Just to wrap up, I wanted to do something that I think is you see it in a lot of football media across the world. It seems to have been a bit of a breakout tournament in terms of global interest and people wanting to see how they could maybe get involved and follow the women's game at home and outside of just the big tournaments. For people who are based in China or for our listeners overseas who pay close attention to the men's game, what can they do to kind of get involved? You mentioned it's a curtailed league season this year, obviously. Yep. Are the teams, is it similar to Europe where it's all, the same clubs who run men's and women's teams? Is there a bit more geographical spread? What can people do to follow their local ladies' side?
At the moment, it's not. From next season, things could change dramatically. All the men's Super League teams have been told, in order to fulfill the registration criteria next year, they must also have a women's team. At the moment, they're in the process of organizing that. Some will undoubtedly take over existing women's teams. Others will start from the bottom. It depends on their ambition, on their investment, etc. At the moment, I would say none of them are particularly clear about their plans. That will all come through in the second half of the year. But in terms of this year, I mean, there's two leagues, like I said, at the top end with foreign players permitted. They have eight teams in each league. The geographical spread, certainly of the Super League, which I guess we'll focus on, is pretty good. You've got the eight teams of Beijing, Shanghai, Guangdong, Changchun, Jiangsu, Wuhan, and I probably shouldn't have gone down this route. And there's one more, I forget, but they're Dalian. So they're well spread out. You've got northeast, center of China, eastern China, and also then Guangdong in the south. So in that sense, most, I guess, of our listeners will be relatively close to one of those teams if they're living in China, unless they're in the far west, in which case you've got Sichuan or Yunnan, I guess, as your local teams. The best way to follow it, I guess, is through the Weibo accounts of the team before the games. They'll put up, you know, when the games are, etc. What we can do, perhaps, I'll talk with yourself and Cameron. Perhaps we can publish some kind of fixture list on the website that people can check. There are sometimes minor changes, but it should be at least give people an idea for the season of when they should be checking. And then, beyond that, just try and get to games, I guess. They're not always the easiest to get to. Guangdong play in Meizhou, for example. Jiangsu's team play out of their training ground, which is a pain in the ass to get to. But certainly Beijing is very easy. They play city center in Shandong town. Shanghai play at Jiading. Wuhan is city center again. So we'll try and get a fixture list up on the Wild East Football website, and we'll also put some links up, I guess, to the club Weibo accounts, and then people can go as they please, I guess.
Fantastic. And yes, we'll make sure we get on that by the time this interview is released. Chris, always a pleasure to have you on the pod. Thanks for sharing some insight there.
No, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
And hopefully we can talk about your favourite, foot-stamping current Dalian player next time we get you on as a guest.
Well, I'm going to put him forward, I think, as the replacement for Joshua Tran as the women's national team coach. I think they need a bit of that attitude in the team, and Qin Song would be a great guy to take the team forward.
Led by General Qin. Can't say fairer than that. Fantastic. Speak to you again soon, Chris. Cheers.
Thank you.
And we had to get a Qin Song reference in there at the end as well, of course. Some traditions of the pod will never die. Before we do wrap up this week, though, listeners, we've got a couple of questions that have come in on Twitter that I wanted to take. Firstly, this is a good one, actually, from regular listener and questionnaire Richesco. With Kim Shin-wook joining a long list of Koreans to play in the CSL, can we explore why clubs have signed lots of Koreans but only ever signed four Japanese players, even back in the days with the AFC plus one quota? Brandon, I'm going to come to you on this one. You seem to be our most informed kind of Korean football spotter of the three of us.
I think what it comes down to is that a lot of the talented, I mean, most of the talented Japanese players, the best Japanese players, are all over in Europe, and what's left isn't exactly overly attractive for one, and two, the J League pays, I think, overall the salaries the guys get are better than what they get in Korea, and so it's sort of easier for the Chinese clubs to sort of pick some of the best of what's left in Korea from the K League than it is from the J League.
Yeah, do you think, Cam, as well, there's kind of a cultural element to it in terms of Korean footballing style and perhaps culture being a closer fit to China than kind of the big differences between Japan and China?
Yeah, I think Brandon's right. I would say that the fact that Japan and China don't get on very well is probably something to do with it, at least in some cases. The Korean question is a good one because it wasn't that long ago, well, let's say we go back 10 years, that Chinese players would often go and play in Korea. So it shows you how much things have turned around. I think that, as Brandon alluded to, that's a lot of that to do with the financial side. I would actually argue that that closeness is somewhat would apply to Japan as well, maybe not quite as much as Korea, but like I say, I think the historical relationship between Japan and Korea, sorry, Japan and China, doesn't encourage Japanese players to come here.
Yeah, some good points kind of all around there. And one other question to wrap up on, this from John Halbert. Now that Dalian have lost Jojun, and unfortunately we didn't quite get through a pod without mentioning that guy, Cam, do we see any chance for a more sensible transfer approach with all the Wanda money up there? Brandon, do you think Wanda are going to invest wisely, or are they still going to be looking to make statements?
Well, I mean, you can make statements and invest wisely, but I think that the policy is definitely, it seems like they're going to keep looking at after big, or looking out for big names. The situation with Carrasco seems to have passed now with the new manager, and Hamsik, who was really struggling, obviously he has a pre-existing relationship with Benitez, and so I think he's most likely going to stay. So I'm not sure that they're in the market for a new player right now, just because of the changes that have happened. But yeah, if they were, I think they'd make a splashy signing, but I'm not sure if it's going to happen.
Stability there in the north. Cam, I feel while we're talking about Dalian, we have to mention Rafa's blog a little bit. I'm amazed that none of us nominated this for Phenomenon of the Week.
Yeah, I should have done that. I think that's really unfortunate. I mean, I have to take my hat off to Benitez. I thought it was a really informative post he made on his blog. I'm not sure exactly if he wrote it himself or he gave a ghostwriter some pointers. Generally, it's a pretty insightful view into a foreign coach's first steps into China. But, you know, his claim that Dalian is a team which is steeped in tradition, has won lots of trophies, I'm afraid is very erroneous. In fact, I'd spoke to Zobian, who's the leader of the old Geelong Blue Wave fans, and he just kind of laughed and he said, yeah, it's like the boss of Liverpool one day suddenly didn't want to invest in Liverpool anymore, then later on he bought Everton and said that Everton had loads of trophies. So I think that's a good way of explaining what the view is up there.
Okay, well, my regards to Zobian, as always, an insightful chap, and master of ceremonies up there in Dalian, say no more. That has been an action-packed pod as always this week. We've got through a lot. There's a midweek round of fixtures this week, so we'll have a chance to reflect on the carnage that's caused when we get back to you next week. But this is wrapping things up for our pod this week. Brandon, thank you as always for your insights from the north.
It was fun, Steve. Talk to you next week.
And Cam, thanks for your input from Shanghai as usual. And until next week, this has been your Chinese football podcast brought to you by Wildies Football. I've been your host, Steve Crooks. If you enjoy the pod, please do rate, review, share, or leave us a donation on Patreon. Every little helps. And we'll see you next week. Thank you for listening.
The Chinese football podcast brought to you by Wildies Football.
全场比赛结束了，我们终于出现了。